Funding for Smart Talk is provided by Capital Blue Cross. For 80 years, Capital Blue Cross has offered products that provide peace of mind and promote good health, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Health and Wellness Centers that provide in-person service and inspire healthy living. Capital Blue Cross is behind you for whatever lies ahead. More information is at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross. Live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle. Its 11 principal investigators and 12 nurse coordinators conduct research efforts to advance cardiovascular medicine. Information at upmcpinnacle.com/myheart.
Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. More than 100 people have died from the flu this season in Pennsylvania, and it's considered the worst flu season in 10 years. 100 years ago, the 1918 flu pandemic killed 50 to 100 million people, or about 3 to 5% of the world's population. 500 million people were infected. It was one of the worst natural disasters in world history, maybe even worse than the Black Death in the 1300s. What happened a century ago? That's the discussion we have on the first portion of today's Smart Talk with Dr. Michael Nyberg, professor of history and chair of war studies in the Department of National Security and Strategy at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. Dr. Nyberg, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Great to be back.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Those numbers I just quoted are difficult to fathom. Can you give us a scope of the 1918 flu pandemic?
One thing to keep in mind is that it was global. It was because of so many men and animals coming together in places, in military bases, on ships, moving across the world. This disease moved from wherever it started across the globe incredibly quickly. So it's the scale, it's the scope, it's the speed. It's also the fact that this is happening as men, animals, and goods. People are moving around the world, so there was really no way to stop it. There was no way to slow down the pace of that movement. There was no way to control it. So public health officials were aware of what they were up against, and they were also aware that they simply lacked the resources to deal with it.
I mentioned 50 to 100 million. That's a big disparity. But what it says is that 100 years later, we still don't have a handle on just how widespread this is. 50 million is enough, but that double that number of people could have been killed.
Right. 50 million is the margin of error. That'll give you a sense of just the scope and what we're dealing with. And 50 million is what, 5-6 New York cities? And that's the margin of error. And part of the problem, this is a problem historians face all the time in things like this. We don't have accurate records. We don't have records being kept in the same place in the same way. We have people who are listed as dying from disease or dying from other causes that we now think could have been connected to the flu. And we have large parts of the world, India, Africa, where the records just aren't kept in the way that we would like them. So it really is a difficult thing. Even among the armies of the First World War, each army didn't record deaths and casualties in the same way. Each part of each army didn't record in quite the same way. So trying to figure out what those numbers are and trying to get a handle on them is incredible. And I think the way you stated it was best, that just understanding how big a disparity it is almost sufficient, better than the number itself, to understand the scale and scope.
You have written extensively, written several books, and you're considered an authority on World War I. How does the flu pandemic of 1918 relate to World War I?
The key thing, I think, is, again, this movement of people, mostly men, but not only men, animals, equipment, everything being moved around the world. So just to take the case of the French, they're bringing people in from Senegal, they're bringing people in from Indochina, they're bringing people in from sub-Saharan Africa, they're bringing people in from all over the world. American soldiers infected with this disease come to Europe. European soldiers infected with this disease move from, say, the Russian front to the German front. All of that movement is creating an epidemiological environment that nobody was prepared for. And doctors certainly knew that wars create disease. There had been a big history of this. There had been doctors looking into this. But this is the first time probably since the Columbian Exchange in the 16th century when you see this many people moving this great a distance. And as that's happening, all of these germ environments are coming together. So I think it's really hard to understand the flu epidemic without understanding the context of the First World War.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. When you say that the French alone were bringing in all these people from sub-Saharan Africa and Indochina, China, and we're going to talk about that in just a moment, but what were those people coming into Europe for?
The largest volunteer army in the First World War that is raised without conscription or a draft of any kind is actually the Indian Army, 1.4 million men from India who fought mostly for the British. And they go to France. I fought always for the British. They go to France for the most part, but they also go to Mesopotamia. They go to Egypt. They go all over the place. So you have to remember that the First World War is a war of empires. It's not a war of nation states. So I use the French case. I'll now use the British one. When Britain went to war, it meant that India went to war, Canada went to war, South Africa went to war, New Zealand went to war. I could go on and on. What that means is you've got people literally from all four corners of the globe coming together. And those are just the combatants. That doesn't include the neutrals, the trade, all the other things that are going on. So it is a massive, massive movement of people.
Were people, when they came into Europe from those other countries, those other continents at that time, were they tested for disease?
No, they are given in some cases a very light screening, but it's just simply impossible to screen 1.4 million people coming from India to the Western Front, which happens in 1915. The British did make a decision to move those Indian soldiers away from the Western Front and send them back to places like Mesopotamia. I don't think that was primarily based on disease or questions of disease, but you will hear British doctors saying that it's better to get them into an environment that they're more physically used to. That can be a code, that can be a way to talk about disease and the impact of disease.
What it reminded me of was Ellis Island here in the United mm-hmm. States, when immigrants came into the United States from mostly Europe. They were all screened. I don't know how extensive the tests were, but they were all screened for disease and physical ailments. Was it comparable to that, or was what was happening here in the United States a little more extensive?
Well, the motivation is a little bit different. So in the Ellis Island case, the motivation of government officials is to keep people with infectious disease from coming into the country and creating these infections. Army doctors, especially before the flu pandemic really hits in 1918, their motivation is to get as many men to the front line as possible in the interest of winning the war. So I've never come across anything that would suggest a screening process like the one that you're talking about. And I think the main reason is that the motivation of the doctors are quite different. And this becomes a problem when the flu epidemic hits in 1918 in full force. It's not the Army medical systems are not structured to deal with something like flu. They're really structured to deal with light to moderate injuries on the battlefield to turn those men around and get them back into the front lines. It's a different kind of medicine.
This is probably a good time to talk about this, that throughout history, not just World War I, but I think to the Civil War, American Revolution, that many conflicts, if not all conflicts, that at least a large percentage of the people who were fighting those wars died of disease mm-hmm. rather than died in battle, correct?
Almost always, the number of deaths from disease is higher than the deaths from battle until very, very recently in history. So the first big innovation is the Franco-Prussian War, when the Germans, led by Dr. Joseph Lister, the man for whom Listerine is named, really began to think in terms of modern antiseptic medicine. The 1898 Spanish-American War, more Americans die of yellow fever than die from the enemy, and that's a wake-up call to the U.S. Army to start thinking about infectious disease and to start thinking about these problems. This is where Walter Reed, the famous doctor, becomes well-known, when the Army and civilian doctors, too, are thinking about the way that bringing all these men together in relatively unsanitary conditions creates the conditions and the underlying conditions for pandemics. And it's not really until the Second World War that ratio of killed to died by disease to killed in combat begins to switch the other way.
If you have a question or a comment about this fascinating topic, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Our guest today, Dr. Michael Nyberg, who is professor of history and chair of the war studies in the Department of National Security and Strategy at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. 1-800-729-7532. When we talked earlier about there's a lot we don't know, one of the things that, or one of the aspects of this that that not everyone agrees on is where the pandemic originated. From your studies, from your research, what's your thoughts on that?
So I'm not an epidemiologist, so my understanding of this comes from reading reports written by epidemiologists, and there seems to be at least three popular theories. One is that it began at Fort Riley, Kansas. That is, it began in the United States. And then as American soldiers went, you can track the disease from Fort Riley to other American military bases, Camp Devers in Massachusetts, Philadelphia, as soldiers are getting on troop ships to go across the ocean. There's significant evidence that's one route of transmission. A second theory is that it began in China, which requires a little bit of First World War history to understand, but put very simply, the Chinese government did not want to enter World War I, but they did raise about 95,000 Chinese laborers that they sort of volunteered to the French army in order to free up French soldiers. So those Chinese laborers went from China to Canada, arriving in Vancouver and then going across by railroad. And then from the eastern coast of Canada, they went to France. And there's a sort of track of epidemiology that would support that. And there's a third theory that it may in fact have been two simultaneous origins of this disease, which would account for its rapid spread and account for the virulence of it. But there's simply not enough evidence around to really definitively prove any of them. What we can say for sure is that the disease, although it was called the Spanish flu, did not originate in Spain.
And it's time to ask that question. Yeah. Why was it referred to as the Spanish flu?
Spain was a neutral country in World War I, so Spain did not have the same level of press censorship that the belligerents did. So for France, for Britain, for Germany, there's an incentive to censor this news so that it doesn't get out and panic people. Spain didn't have that condition, and the Spanish king died of this disease. So those two things associated, that is, it first appeared in the Spanish media and the death of the Spanish king. It has hereafter been known as the Spanish flu, even though it's impossible that it began in Spain.
Even today, there are people who will refer to it as the Spanish flu, and it had nothing to do with Spain.
It had nothing to do with Spain other than Spain's press censorship laws and the fact that the king happened to get it.
You mentioned that you're not an epidemiologist, but something that, it's hard to believe that something as small or a place as small as Fort Riley, Kansas, that it would originate there and make its way around the world, that 50 to 100 million people were killed.
This is why I think the First World War context is so important. If those men are staying in Fort Riley, if they're staying in the Kansas area, then maybe this disease doesn't spread the way that it does. But of course, those men go to all across the eastern seaboard of the United States. They go from there to France. From there, it spreads. As these men remember, this disease hits in two waves. There's a 1918 early summer version, and then there's a later version in 1918. Then there's another wave that hits in 1919, and you can understand that by the war ending and all of those men returning home to their home communities. So again, without the war, I think it's hard to see the way that this epidemic spreads, the way that it spreads and spreads as fast as it spreads.
Just in recent years, there have been a number of scientists who have concluded, or at least they feel pretty sure, that it originated in China. And by the way, many of them see it as an avian flu, that it originated from birds, that those laborers that you mentioned, the 95,000 that went to Vancouver and then were shipped by train, by the way, in sealed boxcars, sealed boxcars that went across Canada to Halifax and then on to Europe, where they served behind the lines while the French and British were in the front. And one of the reasons they based that theory on is that there were fewer Chinese that died of the Spanish flu or in the pandemic, meaning that when it first started, that their immune systems were able to fight it off. What do you think of that theory?
I mean, if I was a lawyer, I would say that's circumstantial evidence that certainly suggests but doesn't prove. We know those men had the flu. There is a Chinese cemetery, I think it's in Alberta, of Chinese laborers that died en route on the Pacific, on the railway going from Pacific to Atlantic. So we know they were infected. We know that many of them died from the flu. There's just no way to prove it 100 years later. There's no way to definitively prove it. Most of the recent stuff that I've read seems to suggest the Fort Riley answer a little more. But again, it doesn't have to be an either or. This could have been something that developed in multiple places.
And there's a real bias in North America and Europe against Chinese that were often referred to or called lazy. Maybe they were just sick.
Well, and again, you noted putting them in a sealed train. I mean, that's in part because of the racism that in North America to try to ensure that these people didn't come in contact, in this case, with Canadians. There's a wonderful book written about these Chinese laborers that details a lot of this racism that they faced, not just in Canada, but of course in France as well. And the fact that they may have been carrying influenza with them wouldn't help that at all.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
Smart Talk is supported by Capital Blue Cross, providing health care coverage accepted by doctors and specialists in all 50 states. More information is available at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, committed to reducing hospital-acquired infections and readmission rates. More information on UPMC Pinnacle's achievements in patient safety can be found at upmcpinnacle.com/quality.
Our guest during this portion of the program is Dr. Michael Nyberg, who is professor of history and chair of war studies in the Department of National Security and Strategy at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. We're talking about the 1918 flu pandemic 100 years ago. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Let's take some phone calls. Lenny is in Lancaster. Lenny, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
Good morning, Doctor. Quick question for you. I read a book. It was basically a general history on World War One. And at the end of the war, there was a, and you're familiar with the book. I just don't remember the name of the person who wrote it. At the end of the war, there was a colonel. He had like an Alabama regiment, and he had given his troops copious amounts of rum, and not one of his troops died. As part of what was said in the book, is he didn't lose anybody to the flu. I was curious if you knew that story. And the other thing, too, is with the nature of pandemics, are you concerned with modern terrorism resurrecting some of these monstrous diseases like smallpox or other things like that?
Lenny, thank you very much. A couple good questions. Prescribing alcohol as a way to fight off the flu.
They were trying everything. They were trying alcohol. They were trying local remedies. They were going to talk to peasants in France. I remember coming across one report where they were telling their men to smoke cigarettes as often as possible and hope that the cigarette smoke would kill the virus. They're trying absolutely everything. And the cigarette thing especially struck me as just an act of complete desperation on their part. So it wouldn't surprise me if officers were giving their men alcohol, hoping that that would do it. I'd be surprised if that really was the reason that he didn't lose anybody. The second, yes, of course, it would be a nightmare scenario if a terrorist group were to get a hold of something and were able to introduce it into American society or into anywhere. I know there are folks that are thinking about this, that are worried about it, that are trying to figure out how to prevent something like that. But sure, it's something that worries me.
The flu, could the flu kill as many people? I mean, it would be difficult to believe that the flu could kill as many people as it did 100 years ago, because we have made a lot of advances in, as far as treatment, as far as vaccines, that kind of thing. But is the flu one of those things that a terrorist group could spread?
I think you're probably right. Again, I'm not a doctor, so I don't know. But, you know, there are unknown unknowns. There are things that we just don't know. So I would hate to bet the future on the hope that that's not possible. And I would rather know that there are specialists in epidemiology out there thinking about this and trying to figure out ways of prevention.
Let's take a call from DJ in Hummelstown. DJ, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I was in the military in the mid-70s. And I remember lining up and getting shot after shot after shot before we went overseas. Does anybody out there know how many, you know, shots you get, you know, in a normal military life?
I don't know the number, but there certainly are protocols for deployment, even just for civilian travel into certain regions. You have to have certain infections, certain precautions. We all, as civilian employees of the U.S. government, got flu shots. If I were to be sent to a place where yellow fever or some other kind of disease was prevalent, I'd be required to get those same vaccinations. I think the same thing is true of civilian travelers as well. If it's not required, it's certainly a very good idea.
We actually had a vaccine card.
Yeah.
And I remember it had like 10 to 15 different shots that you had to prove that you had it within the last this year or 5 years or whatever it was.
Mm. Hey, DJ, thank you very much for your call. 100 years ago, there was not a flu vaccine, but were there shots given to soldiers going overseas?
Not that I'm aware of. There were folks worried about this. There were folks thinking about it. Dr. William White at Johns Hopkins was one and trying to think about ways to create some sort of preventative treatment. What they determined was that the best way to do preventative treatment was to do the kinds of things they did. Folks don't know this, but they canceled most outdoor events in cities like Philadelphia that were having problems. You can go back and look at, you know, even college football games. They canceled much of the college football season. The idea was to get people separated, reduce the contact, reduce the number of people who were exchanging disease, and hope that that would do it.
When we think about how the flu is spread in America and around the world today, it often is coming into contact with other people, but touching doorknobs. I mentioned to you this microphone here that is used by numerous people in a day's time, that those are some of the ways that the flu is spread today. We think about World War One, and we think about those trenches in Europe, filthy, water everywhere, you know, stagnant water. So, okay, coming into contact was one thing, but what are some of the other ways that the environment in Europe, on the battlefields of Europe, help this disease spread?
It's moving people and animals together. It's moving people from very different places together. You have to understand the average European or American city was an unhealthy place to be. The First World War had seen dysentery outbreaks, cholera outbreaks, all kinds of diseases that had doctors really, really worried that something really bad could end up at the end of this. The caller that mentioned terrorism, there were people worried that the enemy might intentionally try to infect soldiers on the other side in some way. So these are really, really incredibly unsanitary, very dirty, very bad environments. And there's really no way to prevent that. There's really no way to stop it. It's winter. They don't have a lot of cover. They don't have a lot of responses to the exposure. So everybody knew these were really, really terrible environments, which is why I would underscore you can't separate out the flu from the First World War. They're intimately connected to one another.
Did the other side get sick?
Everybody was sick, and the disease knew no boundaries at all. And we as historians are still trying to figure out the relative impact on the two sides. And we think simply because Germany was under greater pressure from the British blockade, so food and medicine couldn't get into Germany from overseas. We think that the German army was probably more affected on the battlefield. We think that the Germans slowed the deployment of troops from the Russian front, which closes down in early 1918, to the Western front. They wanted to move troops to France before the U.S. could deploy in large numbers. We think they probably slowed that down because so many soldiers in the East had the flu. We know the United States stopped sending reinforcements from the U.S. over to France because of concerns about flu spread. So it absolutely had a battlefield impact. We think that impact was greater on the Germans, though, again, it's really, really difficult to prove.
You may have just answered this question, but did this flu pandemic contribute to the end of World War One?
We think so. Again, the Germans were defeated on the battlefield. That's the main thing. They knew it. They had planned for it. Their final offensives in 1918, they knew to be their last. They were either going to win it in the spring and summer of 1918 or they would lose. But what we do know is the Germans were also afraid of what was happening on the German home front. They were afraid of a revolution like the one that had just broken out in Russia. And the flu is another example of just how degraded conditions on the German home front had become. So we think it's a factor. I don't know of any historian who believes it's the factor, but it's certainly playing in. And the ability of the United States Army to continually send men overseas, the ability of the United States Army to continue growing when every other army was in decline, in part because of the flu, really was what did it.
Let's take a phone call from Bill in New Cumberland. Bill, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Scott. Just a very personal comment first and then a question. My dad was stricken with the flu when he was just a child living in New York City. He was wrapped in a blanket for over a week. And an older brother did not survive. A younger sister never was stricken by the flu. And they were about to give my dad last rites, and somehow they kept delayed that. My question is, how did they finally beat back the epidemic? What was done to finally curb it? Because I know in New York City it was quite devastating, and other people were stricken by it, and many died.
Hey, Bill, before you go, a question about your father and your family. Was this during the 1918 pandemic?
Yes, it was.
It was. It was back in that era.
Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm. Hey, thank you very much for your call.
So we don't think they did anything. We think that there were two waves of this flu, and then it went away for whatever epidemiological reasons that is. I've heard epidemiologists explain to me that the two flu waves probably made enough people immune that it began to decline in its lethality. But there's no definitive active step that people took to reduce the lethality of the flu.
You know, it's hard to talk about this without bringing in some of the epidemiology, the medical reasons, and neither one of us can speak as experts in that area. But one of the unique aspects of this is that today you hear about it, that the most vulnerable populations to the flu are the very young children and older people. Mm-hmm. Whose immune systems, children, they haven't been built up yet, older people whose immune systems are not as strong as they once were. What was unique about this flu pandemic was it struck healthy people. And that leads you to believe that it was a different strain or a new strain anyway that led to this.
Probably. It also could be, as we were explaining, that it's occurring in these unsanitary environments of the Western Front and in military camps, which is where disproportionately young, healthy people are. So, again, connecting it to the wartime context is really, really important.
And I don't know whether you can answer this question or not, but how was the flu treated in those days? I read one account that castor oil was one of the things that they did with a sore throat.
They tried everything. They tried things that now to us would look either completely ineffective, like giving people rum and cigarettes, trying to tell them to stop it that way, or just putting up bed sheets between beds in hospitals, hoping that that might prevent it. Surgical masks, people going around spraying chemicals, hoping to kill whatever they could try. And it doesn't appear that anything they did in 1918, 1919 was particularly effective. But they're searching. There were a certain small number of doctors, William White from Johns Hopkins, probably the most famous, their medical library is still named for him, really had a better understanding of what was causing this. But again, he was aware that given the scale and scope, there was little that public health officials could do.
This is so fascinating in that, there are many aspects of it that are fascinating, but this was just 100 years ago. One positive from it is that it shows how far we've come as a society and in science in the past 100 years, but 100 years, a century, is like no time at all.
No time at all. No time at all. So it is a reminder of just, you know, the fragility of our societies and our medical systems, and also a reminder the situation we're in today is not quite the same as World War I, but we are, of course, a global society, people taking flights all over the world, trade coming in all over the world. It is an opportunity for a pandemic to spread as a result. And it requires vigilance. It requires people doing the right things to keep these things from spreading.
Is that the legacy of the 1918 flu pandemic?
I think so. I think that the legacy is being aware, getting on top of these things early. Flu shots obviously have gone a tremendous way towards prevention, even if they're not perfect. Public health is better informed on these issues and just taking these things incredibly seriously. So, you know, I was traveling in Europe and Asia during things like SARS and H1N1, and some of the responses can seem to people a little bit overdone and a little bit overwrought, but far better to overreact and nip these things in the bud than to take a risk of something like what happened 100 years ago.
Dr. Michael Nyberg is professor of history and chair of war studies in the Department of National Security and Strategy at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. He's written extensively about World War I and this era. Dr. Nyberg, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Always great to be here, Scott. Thanks.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. It's President's Day, a holiday that was derived from George Washington and Abraham Lincoln's birthdays. Both Washington and Lincoln are considered two of our best and most successful presidents. What makes a president successful? Is there a difference between being popular and being successful? Joining us for this conversation is Dr. David O'Connell, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Dickinson College. Dr. O'Connell, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
If you'd like to join in our conversation today, what makes a president successful to you? 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf.org. I'm going to start with a question of how a president should be judged.
Well, I think that's a difficult question because we're impossible of coming up with an answer that's completely free from our own biases. Everybody has their own perspectives, and that includes scholars and political scientists like myself. Studies have shown that, for instance, liberal historians are more likely to value idealism as a standard of a good or successful or great president than conservative historians. So I think in terms of how we judge a president, it's ultimately going to come down to your individual values in terms of what you think is important for a president to achieve.
And what you just described with historians making these judgments, I mean, the American people have their own judgments. You know, it comes up every 4 years for one thing. But in hindsight, whether a president was successful or not, how much time has to go by before a president can truly be judged successful, a failure, or just an average president?
Yeah, that's a tough question, too. I do think it needs to be a substantial amount of time so that you can see the impact of certain public policies, that we can have a better understanding of what the consequences of those decisions were and make an informed judgment about whether or not those were the right decisions. I often make that point in the context of George W. Bush. When Bush left office, a lot of people said that he was a terrible president. Some would even make the argument the worst president overall, and I don't necessarily think that's a fair judgment. But we do need time. If you think about what his most important and impactful decision was, it was probably his foreign policy decisions to invade Iraq and Afghanistan. And whether those are the right decisions or not, we still don't know. It really depends on whether or not those countries become beacons of democracy in the Middle East that trigger flourishing liberal societies that ultimately provide opportunity and rights for disaffected young men who might otherwise become terrorists, and thereby eliminate the key security threat that the United States faces going forward. It's not going to happen in a year. It's not going to happen in 10 years. It's going to take a while. I do think we've seen presidents that over decades, we've come to think about differently. Truman's a good example. His foreign policy decisions have really been validated by the course of history, but that took 40 or so years. So I think it has to be a while, and we also need to have time to get access to classified documents. As more information becomes declassified, we have a better understanding of how things actually took place within the White House, and then we can better understand whether presidents were good leaders or not.
Interesting what you said about George W. Bush, because I think most people, if they're being honest, would look at the decision to invade Iraq as the disaster that many lives were lost, many families were impacted by. Afghanistan, we are still fighting mm-hmm. in Afghanistan, the longest war that the United States has ever been involved with. So decisions that George W. Bush made 10 years ago still have an impact on Americans today. So it's interesting that you say, obviously, there not enough time has passed for people to look at, because most people probably would say that that was a failed presidency.
Yeah, and I don't think that Bush's presidency was
stellar.
Stellar, yeah. I think that's fair. His second term was about as bad a second term as you can imagine, not just with worsening violence in Iraq, but also the disastrous response to Hurricane Katrina, economic collapse at the end of his presidency as well. So I do think that, you know, he's probably going to go down as a below average president. But over time, if things change in Iraq and Afghanistan, and you're right, this is something that is still affecting the lives of Americans today. Trump's major foreign policy speech was on his Afghanistan strategy. And so it's something that I think it's still an issue and something that could potentially improve his reputation or worsen it. And maybe that's the ultimate judgment, that this was a disastrous foreign policy decision, that the United States never should have invaded Iraq, that there were fundamental miscalculations about what would happen in the aftermath, that U.S. military planners did not successfully make the arrangements that were needed to secure a prosperous post-democratic or post-Saddam Hussein democratic society, and so forth.
So what attributes do successful presidents or have successful presidents had?
Well, for me, I think that two loom large. One is that presidents have to have a realistic sense of their possibilities for leadership. I think one of the fundamental mistakes presidents make is that they overestimate their abilities to influence American politics. One of the things I continually try to stress to public audiences is that presidents cannot create opportunities for change. They can only exploit those opportunities for change when they exist. So presidents struggle to move public opinion. Their independent executive authorities are ultimately weak and subject to limitations by the other branches. Congress really is the dominant actor in American politics, not the president. So if you have an opportunity, you know, like Barack Obama in his first year, where you've got a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, you're coming into office with 68% approval. A lot of your ideas are popular at the moment because we're seeing a upsurge in liberalism after 8 years of a conservative Republican president, and of course, anxious public due to the economic dislocation that was happening at the time. That's an opportunity that then you can exploit. And so presidents who recognize those opportunities and exploit them, that's important. Second, I'd say that presidents have to be good bargainers, that because it's a Congress-centered system, you have to have the ability to make deals and actually convince members, even in your own cabinet, that what you want is in their own interest.
So of using those two definitions of the attributes that make a president successful, which presidents would you point to as being able to, they were successful because they were able to exploit those things or to use those things?
Sure. Well, I think that if we look at the historical rankings of great presidents, historians and political scientists agree that the top three are Lincoln 1 and then some variation of either Roosevelt 2 or Washington 2. And so I would certainly point to Franklin Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt for me is a good starting point because he's a modern president. I do think as a political scientist, it's hard for me to compare modern presidents to pre-modern presidents because the role is so fundamentally different. But Roosevelt recognized that he had that opportunity in 1933 when people were clamoring for action in response to the Great Depression. And he was able to ultimately put in place a lot of his legislative priorities very quickly. In his second term, he faced much more difficulty getting legislation through Congress. And he had a shrewd sense in terms of that bargaining standard. He had a shrewd sense of the motivations of other individuals and knowing what makes people tick and what could ultimately be successful in terms of making those kind of arrangements.
Two things you didn't mention. You used the word leadership, but kind of in a different context. There are many people who are looking to the president of the United States to be a leader, to show leadership, that people want to follow him. Another attribute is inspiration, that Americans want to be inspired. And I guess the leadership and inspiration go together. But what about those two attributes?
I think it's important to an extent and for me also, I think about when you think about leadership and inspiration, I also think about moral leadership and inspiring people to be versions of their best self. And I think that historically, that's been something that people haven't necessarily put an emphasis on when it comes to presidential leadership. I would often have these discussions with my class about, say, Bill Clinton and their reaction to his affair with Monica Lewinsky. And many students, as many of the public, willing to excuse that because they liked certain policies that he put in place. And I would always make the point, I don't know why we would accept that kind of behavior from a president, but not from people, who would run a college or a company or in our own daily lives. So I think having that kind of moral gravitas and setting an example, when Barack Obama can speak powerfully about the importance of fatherhood in African-American communities, I think that kind of inspiration and moral leadership is valuable. But I don't know that it's necessarily the number one thing that determines whether a president is successful or great, particularly given the difficulty that presidents have in moving public opinion and actually changing people's minds, which we have very little empirical evidence that they can do.
Every year around President's Day, you see these surveys of historians ranking the presidents. I saw one just this morning from the Brookings Institute that actually had moved Bill Clinton down. He wasn't rated as a great president, but was maybe 10, 11, 12, something like that in the rankings, but moved him down into the teens because of the Me Too movement, that looking at what we're going through as a country today and what we recognize. And so some of the controversies that Clinton had at that time. Also that George W. Bush had actually moved up to about 30th from 35th. So again, as you get farther away from the administration, but those things are interesting. But two of the presidents that I hear most often today, and this is not just historians, I think this is mostly the American people, and depending on what age you're in, age group you're in, of what you remember or hear your parents talking about, Kennedy and Reagan. President Kennedy, very famously, his first inaugural talked about inspiring Americans to do more. And President Kennedy, as a young, vibrant president, did inspire many Americans to get involved and to think about government, think about the Peace Corps, helping other people. President Reagan was very popular. Not all, you know, can't say he was 100% popular with everyone, but he inspired a lot of people, especially Republicans, especially conservatives. Those two presidents, because they were inspiring, because they were popular, what does popularity have to do with being successful?
Well, I think that is an interesting question because I don't know that popularity is necessarily the best measure of success. For one thing, popularity can be cheaply earned. And so if you think about Bill Clinton and his heavy reliance on polls, with his advisor Dick Morris, they had this strategy of triangulation that they would try to develop policies that found that midpoint between the Republicans and Democrats and this rise above the partisan fray. And I don't know that that's necessarily always the type of leadership you want, someone who's doing something that's popular. Indeed, Clinton went so far as he would poll where he should go for vacation. And it came back very negatively that he shouldn't go to Martha's Vineyard because that put him out of touch with the common man, but go to a national park, play baseball, absolutely. And then he made decisions on something as inconsequential as how he spent his private time using polls. Because indeed, sometimes presidents have to do unpopular things. And so one of the examples that I always point to of an unpopular decision that is actually a successful presidential decision would be Gerald Ford's decision to pardon Richard Nixon. At the time, extremely unpopular. Ford came in as president about 71% approval. After that decision, he dropped 21% in the polls, and it almost certainly lost him the presidential election in 1976. Lost the election by 2 points. 7% of voters said they voted against him specifically because of the pardon. At the time, unpopular, but again, talking about how history changes judgments and so forth, over time, I think most people have recognized that that was the correct decision, that saving the country from the even more years of focus on Watergate and a president being put on trial and so forth was the right decision in helping the country move forward. Indeed, Ted Kennedy, who is one of the fundamental opponents of this decision, would later give Ford a Profile in Courage Award. And so sometimes you have to do things unpopular. And I also think popularity and success is problematic in that sometimes presidents are popular for things they're not really responsible for. And the economy is a great example that often when we're talking about presidents being successful and why they're popular, it's because of the economy. Indeed, the state of the economy as a predictor of presidential approval is uncommonly strong, but presidents really don't have much to do with the state of the economy. So much of economic policy is set by other actors, private actors in the market, independent government actors like the Federal Reserve that creates monetary policy. Fiscal policy is jointly determined by Congress, which has their own priorities. And so I don't think it's fair to give presidents popularity and think of them as success for the state of the economy. But people often do that.
Let's take a call from Jim in Enola. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott. This is a fascinating topic. I always enjoy your history programs. For me personally, it's hard to rate presidents that where I did not live through their period in office. But in my experience, the most effective president that whose time I lived through was Lyndon Johnson, and I'm surprised that you haven't brought him up yet. If you look at what he did from early in '64 through 1967 in terms of civil rights, Medicare, Medicaid, environmental legislation, you could go on and on. You know, it was just an amazingly effective presidency, and by the same token, his was one of the most flawed presidencies because of his blind spot when it came to Vietnam. But, if you just want to look at it from the standpoint of an effective presidency, you have to rate Lyndon Johnson at the very top of the list. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your call. Actually, that was my next question, was about underrated, overrated presidents, some that have been tainted by one aspect in particular. Lyndon Johnson is certainly an example of, if you ask people today on the street about Lyndon Johnson, Vietnam probably would be the first thing that would come up. But you take Vietnam away.
How can we do that?
That's right. You can't. But at the same time, there was a lot of transformations that happened in this country under the Johnson administration.
Well, Jim's question was great because it actually connects to the comment that I was making in the question before, because certainly there were a number of really important legislative enactments during Johnson's presidency. Medicare, Medicaid, Civil Rights Act, funding for elementary and secondary education, et cetera, et cetera. But the question is why were those things put into practice, and were they really due to Lyndon Johnson's skills? A lot of people think that the reason these policies were adopted was because of the so-called Johnson treatment, and that he was the tallest president we had, 6'4", physically imposing. Like Franklin Roosevelt, had a great sense of people's motivations, would even go so far as calling the mistresses of senators and urging them to put pressure on their lovers to vote the way that Johnson wanted, and that because of his skills as a person, as someone who could bully people and bribe them, that's why we saw these major legislative enactments. But in terms of the research, it doesn't really support that interpretation, because Lyndon Johnson, on non-unanimous key votes, had no more success than Kennedy or Carter, Democratic presidents serving at a similar time, that didn't have those legislative skills. So I think what's more important in understanding Johnson's legislative success is simply the time in which he served. It was a time in which the liberal opinion of the public was at an all-time high. It was a time at which you saw huge Democratic majorities. And so it goes back to that comment that I made even earlier in the program about recognizing opportunity. So Lyndon Johnson is great by that sense, that he had this opportunity for action and he exploited it, but he also benefited simply by the time in which he served. And I don't know that I would give him exclusive credit for those legislative achievements.
What about the Kennedy effect? I mean, some of those things like civil rights legislation began during the Kennedy administration. And let's face it, there was, after the assassination, the country was in a different kind of situation, even the Congress was still grieving from the assassination of the president.
Yeah, and I definitely give Johnson credit for that. He is the one who brings to fruition most of Kennedy's legislative priorities: civil rights, funding for schools, stimulative tax cut, and so forth. And Johnson wasted no time. That's another thing that presidents have to be aware of, is that the clock is always running. You're going to get less popular over time. You're going to lose seats in Congress as you go. You have to act immediately upon taking office. And he didn't waste that any time upon taking office. In his speech on, I think it's like November 28th, 1963, just a few days after Kennedy's death, he said there could be no better tribute to Kennedy than passing a civil rights law that he had fought for. So I think that I do give him credit to that extent, that he, after taking office, embraced Kennedy's agenda, kept many of Kennedy's senior personnel, and ultimately made those his priorities to build on them.
What happened with Vietnam?
Well, I do think that Vietnam's a complicated thing to discuss, because you can't fairly blame Johnson for Vietnam exclusively. By the time Kennedy died, there were already somewhere between 15,000 to 20,000 U.S. military personnel in Vietnam. And I do think there's an interesting discussion to be had about whether or not any president would have made the same decisions that Kennedy and Johnson made at that time. The basic view was that, you know, if the United States lost a country to communism anywhere, it could trigger a domino effect where countries around the world would then fall to communism. U.S. credibility would be undermined worldwide. And so that the U.S. had to take a stand, even in a country that strategically, like Vietnam, didn't necessarily seem to be that important. So it may have been the case that, faced with those global conditions, any president would have followed the same course of action in getting involved in Vietnam. That being said, we certainly have to hold Johnson responsible for lying to the American public about the extent of Vietnam. Something that was revealed in the Pentagon Papers and something that we know today is that the extent of U.S. involvement was consistently concealed from the U.S. public. And I think if there's anything presidents have a responsibility to the public It's that they have to be honest when U.S. lives are at stake.
We have about 2 minutes left, and you prepared some little-known facts about the presidents. What do you have?
All right. So first one is that, and I think all of these little-known facts illustrate some important points. First one is that it's a story about Richard Nixon playing the piano and his relationship with his mother. So a lot of listeners were probably know that Nixon was an accomplished piano player, played for Duke Ellington at the White House, performed a song for his wife at the Grand Old Opry, but he had a very tight, complicated relationship with his mother, Hannah, who didn't necessarily give him a lot of love when he was growing up. So the point here is that it illustrates how presidents can form important presidential behaviors early in their lives. And so the story is that Nixon and his mother were, when Nixon was in the vice presidency, they were attending a performance of a great piano player. And Nixon's mother turns to him and says, you know, if you had kept up with your lessons, that could be you up there. And of course, Nixon's vice president of the country at that time.
Wow.
And it says
tough
that,
mom.
Yeah, Nixon was desperate for approval, and it made him kind of resentful when he didn't receive it, whether it was from his mother or the Harvards. Secondly, is that Truman had this habit of writing these letters, longhand spasms. Whenever he was angry, sometimes he would mail them, like a letter that he wrote to critics of his daughter's singing. And I think that shows that presidents, they're humans. They respond to the stress like normal people. The third is that Herbert Hoover would wear these high starched collars. And that was a sign of fashion at the time. It's something I've written about in my own research. And those collars actually sent a message. And that's the point, is that presidents send a message in whatever they do, is that because he was dressing like an aristocrat during the Great Depression, people got the sense that he didn't care about the struggles that people were going through simply by the way he was dressing.
All those things send messages.
Yes.
Well, fascinating. Dr. David O'Connell, who is an assistant professor of political science at Dickinson College, thank you very much for being with us today.
Always a pleasure.
So happy President's Day, folks. I'm sure there are a lot of other places today that you'll read about some presidential history, and this is always, always fascinating. Coming up tomorrow, there is a special program, speaking of history, taking Smart Talk's place between 9 and 10. It's a Black History Month special that's coming up tomorrow called The Freed People. That's coming up tomorrow at 9 a.m. On Wednesday, we return with a discussion, speaking of historic icons, about Mr. Rogers. It's the 50th anniversary of the debut of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. That will be on Wednesday.
Smart Talk is produced by WITF as part of our mission to deliver relevant, high-quality programming. Support comes from Capital Blue Cross, which shares WITF's commitment to being a trusted resource in our communities. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by the team of cardiologists, surgeons, nurses, physicians assistants, and rehabilitation specialists from Pinnacle Health Cardiovascular Institute, part of UPMC Pinnacle, delivering a broad range of traditional and highly specialized procedures.